Dave, and please come to order the regular meeting of the House Labor and Commerce Committee, time is 1:30, March 2nd, 1986. All members are present. First item of business today, I'd like to take up House Bill 532. And act relating to civil action demanding license bill, civil procedure 1149-5868, providing for effective date. Representative Copeland.
Yes, could I move that we have CS for House Bill 532, Labor and Commerce, the version of Fort 32786.
Are there any objections? We have for committee substitute for House Bill 532, committee substitute for sponsor substitute for House Bill 532, Labor and Commerce. First thing I'd like to address is on page one on non-economic damages, that section there. The local attorney in town pointed out that the language on line 16 and other non-pecuniary damages, he indicated that what would be included in that is household services that are provided by a spouse. Also, if someone in the bush was supported his family through subsistence, that would not be included and there would be no damages awarded for that. And he suggested that we take out and other non-pecuniary damages. That's Doug Pope with the local attorney. Representative Pope, yeah, we might as well.
Discussion, I'd like to move that amendment number one, page one, line 16, strike non-pecuniary damage, period, and add in place which do not have, and damages which do not have an economic value, period.
That was the suggestion, and you have the letter. Rather than non-pecuniary damages, he wanted to put in language that would say, which do not have an economic value, so that it would allow for recovery of like household services, I guess, and also in a case of subsistence. Representative Pierce?
I object.
Thank you.
I'm gonna get a new copy for the day. Have a new one. Do you wish to take the, amendments up one by one, or do you wish?
I do. I'd like to bring them up one by one.
I'd like to know what the objections are, or I'd like to hear some, I guess, the other side of the story on the economic damage. I think we've discussed the matter in great detail, and I think it's really clear that that no matter what we do, it's going to be a change, because it's a change is going to be a problem. And I just feel very strongly, after looking at all of the information, that it seems reasonable to put a limit on non-economic damages. And the way that this amendment works out, it would be certainly higher than the cap initially put forth in 582, and I think it's probably less than one of the other caps that had been put on in one of the versions, so I saw this as a compromise between the two positions.
I sort of preferred the position that you had drawn before in the Washington State statute, which was a different fact of the age and recovery. I think it's a more reasonable approach to give some guidelines in establishing what's reasonable in a given case to give a person. And I've been told by some people who favor tort reform generally, them out as examples, because
case, an actual case where a little girl was bitten by a dog, and her face was scarred up fairly severely. She had rather minimal medical costs. I think he said $7,000, and she's got a face that's scarred for the rest of her life that she has to live with. And under this particular amendment, the award for that would be under $2,000 for pain and suffering and living with the scars for the rest of your life. So I just want that to be out so that we're aware of what the potential effects could be. Also, another case that he pointed out was if a person was retired or near retirement and ended up being severely disabled in some manner or a loss of limb, that the economic awards would be based simply on the medical costs, and there is potential that the damage could, say if he loses an arm or a leg or something and has to go into the hospital to have it taken care of and he doesn't have any complications, it could be relatively minor hospital costs, and the economic award in that case, since he's retired, I think would be relatively minimal, in which case he'd end up again with having lost a limb or some other particularly devastating damage where he would get a minimal award for pain and suffering. Granted, these are cases that may be one extreme, but we've been talking in extremes during this entire discussion. And one other comment as far as the amendment goes, we have discussed non-economic damages. I'm not so sure that we discussed them as extensively as we might have, and this particular amendment surfaced last Thursday, so that it's hardly been through any extensive discussion. I'm not opposed to a non-economic damage limit. I just think that we need to determine, and certainly it's not going to end here, it has other committees to consider it. I just think that we're jumping faster than we're considered. Representative Collins, you mentioned that you weren't comfortable with the Washington provision because you weren't sure how they reached their conclusion. And I think that rather than look at simply the dollar effect, we need to look at what the potential effect on victims are. That's all I have to say. Representative Falcon.
Mr. Chairman, thank you, sir. Throughout these hearings, rather unusual for me, I've sat and attempted to listen and try to come up with some wisdom on it. And as I look, I've been voting on the various issues before us, and there's only one thing I'm sure of. There's no yellow button. I have to make a decision. I have learned much, and I'm sure there's much more to learn. I respect the tremendous effort you and your staff have put forward, and I respect your work here. I probably, from the both of you, I think Alice indicates she shared that with me, we've learned a lot. In the final analysis, when you're elected as a representative, you've got to reach out to the people that serving, and I've got about 30-some-odd thousand, and they indicate they're looking for relief. They charge me with a lot more wisdom than I have in this particular issue. But there's one thing I think you're right. This isn't the final answer, and I hope as it goes forward here that the highly emotional, very emotional chart, you deal with disfigured babies and people going bankrupt and out of business. I mean, no matter which side, it's electrical. And I would hope that if this thing wanes its way through, that this will be the beginning of the wisdom. And then I would say to those that are more knowledgeable on this particular issue than we who serve, I think you have an obligation to not just your profession, but indeed to the state of Alaska, to get in the closet and hammer each other. Heads around. I haven't seen very much of that. This is the first line of defense of this bill, and I think Representative Barr has done an outstanding job, because it's the place that nobody is going to give an inch. And I would sincerely hope that this is the beginning of wisdom, not just the passage of the law. And this will be the last I'll say, I'm just going to vote from here on. But one of the things I noticed in the document that you gave us last night, first, the Rand Institute of Civil Justice, one of the finest think tanks in the country, and they offer some opinions on what we should or shouldn't do. But one of the things that I would hope that comes out of this, and I talked briefly to the Commissioner of Insurance, that with any law that comes out, be it tort reform or to whatever degree, that we set up a system. That we set up a system to monitor it. And I quote, it says, it would be worthwhile upon passage of any tort form legislation to establish a system for collecting data to develop a statistically significant measure of the effectiveness of tort reform. And I just bring that forward. I'm probably not immediately addressing the amendment, but I did want to share that. Because each of these decisions are difficult ones, no matter whether you vote red or green or yes or no, but unfortunately, there's no yellow out here to reach for. And I thank you for the effort that you put forth on it, and I respect that.
I just want to say for the record that I do share your concerns about each individual case, and I think that there is no legislation that anybody's going to be able to come up with, no matter how much time they spend on it, that's going to treat everybody fairly. There are going to be some winners and some losers, and that's no different than the system which we currently have, which has some winners and some losers, in which I will argue with anybody that it's a fair system at all. So my desire and interest in becoming involved and having some substantive tort reform is that my thought is if we can get the system under control, I believe that we will favorably impact the victim. At the present time, the victim is not favorably impacted by the present system. I think for anyone to infer that is just a real error.
Thank you, Representative Collins. My only concern is that some of the things that we're looking at, although I've heard testimony from various people that we don't need to study this to death, it's ready to go, I definitely do not feel that way. I think that this particular amendment and in this entire subject not something that's been studied to death. I think it needs a lot more study before something should be put in law. And my personal recommendation to the next committee referral will be that they give that ample consideration. I don't feel comfortable with that language at all. The idea is, under this particular amendment, the cap that's spoken of, it was $250,000 was recommended by the Citizens Coalition on Tort Reform. Shall in no case exceed $500,000. That would assume a award of $2 million. And that, granted, $1 million cases are extremely rare, regardless of what the testimony that we've heard. The $1 million cases are rare, and in those cases, maybe we should look at whether or not the non-economic damages that are awarded, whether or not they're justified, and I feel that at least in some of those cases they are. Representative Collins.
I was going to say something, but I think I just left.
Thank you. Okay, there's a motion on the floor. Is there any other comments or debate? If not, those in favor? Those opposed? Motion carries.
Chairman, I would like to introduce my amendment number 2, which relates to periodic payments. And because of it was drafted for the previous CS, the information is different, but it really appears instead of on line 25, it appears on line 2 of page 3 at the top of the page. And all that this does is just to increase the amount from 50,000
$50,000 to $75,000 to make it consistent with the number that we decided upon for arbitration.
That's already included.
Sorry, okay. I've got my amendment. I had my numbers mixed up because I had decided not to use a couple of amendments, so it actually would be by the
proper place would be the bottom of the line of page 9 or the top of page 10.
5B is the one.
5B is the one. Regarding trains.
I
I apologize. I thought this had been included in the new substitute. I do have another amendment to offer.
Representative Dodge, would you like to remove your
motion? Yes.
Any objections to remove the motion to pass the bill? If not, Representative Collins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to move amendment number four.
Yeah.
have an explanation of what that's supposed to do? I mean, theoretically, if you move an amendment, you're at least supposed to justify it.
Well, I think when we've offered the testimony, and my feeling, as I said the other day,
the motion has already been passed. No one seconded. Motion to move the bill.
Mr. Chairman, I move that the substitute response to substitute for House Bill number 532, Labor and Commerce, be moved out of committee on individual recommendation.
Are there any objections? Moves on. Next committee referral is Judiciary. I'd like to announce also that the bill that we had up yesterday, House Bill 589, will not be heard until Friday because the drafting won't be finished. The next bill we'll take up is House Bill 654, an act relating to motor vehicles and providing for an effective date. Individual rights by, you know, having non-smokers insurance or something like that in different classes, but it's not. So we also looked at the different states and the different Canadian
provinces, and we're well aware that most of the Canadian provinces, the western provinces, despite Canadian drivers being a good match for any Massachusetts driver who passed on the left, and their accident rate being quite high, the insurance rates are considerably lower province by province than their counterpart in the eastern United States, or for that matter, what seems to be happening in Alaska. The result, therefore, is to look at the Canadian way of doing it. We have the Manitoba Auto Insurance Plan in the folder. It does seem to work. The intent, of course, is to have a simple method where each person is covered in the state. No driver will be without insurance, and the entire policy will be operated by a private insurance company. It's not intended that which would hold a contract every 3 years. Competitive bid, of course, would have to set the terms as well as the cost. So the state would realize the return. This might also include the prices that people would have. It's not intended to shut out private industry or to supplement, set up an entire parallel state bureaucracy.
Are there any questions? Thank you. Don Cope, Major Insurance.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Don Cope with Division of Insurance. And we are not in favor of this legislation. There are a number of points that I jotted down, and I briefly hit on each of those. The first is that we're a little concerned about placing all the eggs in the basket system. One of the very first things that does, incidentally, is to defeat the action of the Alaska Guarantee Act, which basically provides that when an insurer goes insolvent, all of the other insurers writing that kind of insurance pick up the what's left and pay that off. If you have only one insurer providing the auto liability insurance, there are no other insurers writing that, so there'd be nobody left to pick up the egg, so to speak, if it went down. As to pricing, this would be a great price leveler, of course. Right now, the way the system works is that insurers who are in the marketplace basically select a particular area of interest. We have insurers who write superior risk, and their rate structure is based on that selection. We have insurers who write substandard risk, and their rates are based on that selection. Each of those insurers has a price for the opposite of what they're selecting. In other words, the superior risk company would also have rates for the substandard risk, but those rates are going to be so low that they'll never accept a piece of business in that area. On the other hand, if you've got an insurance company who is writing substandard business, they also have rates for the standard risk, but those rates are considerably higher than what any standard risk would go for. What this would in effect do is it would level the prices so that those who have good driving records would be paying more and those who have bad driving records would be paying less. The same bucks ultimately would be in the system, but it would be distributed differently. It would be a subsidy in effect. One of our real concerns is the effect this would have on the current infrastructure. There are insurance agents out there. There are, for instance, State Farm has insurance agents all over the state. You'd be taking away a principal piece of their business because, as I understand the bill, this would all be handled by a bid-selected operator and a bid-selected insurer, which would mean that there really is no room for some of these other folks in the system. If you're figuring up today, that's something like $10 million We're concerned about the effect on market availability. This bill will deal with the auto liability, the liability portions of coverage. It would not be dealing with the auto physical damage portion of coverage. Currently, there's something like $129 million of premium in automobile liability and physical damage. $67 million of that is in auto liability. It may be enough that some markets would just not be interested in providing the other half. We see some market availability concerns. Whether they would materialize or not, I can't say. There would be an effect, we believe, on homeowners insurance. It's indirect against market availability. To the degree that an insurer comes in to write business and it is able to rope off, if you will, enough of the marketplace to keep it down, and you remove a chunk of that so that there is no longer enough to keep them here and they can go. So we're concerned about that. Certainly, if they don't go, there may be an impact on the service that would be left, because you still have fewer bucks in the pot to provide the services that would be needed. That's a concern. There is some question as to whether certain kinds of insurers would be able to bid under this process, such as a mutual. We know of one mutual, for example, that would not avail itself of this, and they provide a sizable market. USAA selects a particular marketplace, former military officers. They would not, by their very structure, be able to operate under this kind of thing, so that would be a market that's definitely not gone. There are some questions as to whether State Farm Mutual could operate under this system. Since there again is a mutual, in a mutual, all of the insured are members of the company, in effect. So there's some concern about that. But I think there may also be, this probably should be checked out. We haven't gone to get a legal opinion or anything, but there may be a constitutional question as to whether you can set up requirement where you require all people to buy their insurance from a particular private concern. One of the